طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. On May 4th of this year, an important event took place at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. It was a forum called Not Backing Down, and dealt with the constant assault by pro-Israeli organizations to shut down pro-Palestinian voices. Ironically, which in fact made the point, there were serious attempts to prohibit this very forum from taking place by the Zionist lobby, including an unsuccessful lawsuit which emphasized the need for this forum to challenge this systematic campaign to silence the Palestinian narrative. This morning we feature voices from the UMass Forum, the second of our presentations of the event on This Week in Palestine. This morning you will hear moderator Vijay Prashad introducing speakers Linda Sarsour, Mark Lamont Hill, and Pink Floyd's Roger Waters.
Linda Sarsour. Linda Sarsour is with Empower Change, the largest Muslim-led social and racial justice organization in the United States. She is well known as the co-chair of the Women's March. She was the lead plaintiff in Sarsour versus Trump. Boy. That's where it begins and ends, right? Linda Sarsour, my sister in struggle.
Thank you. What up, UMass Amherst? I'm so deeply honored and humbled to be here with all of you today. Dave, I already loved you, but now I just love you a whole lot more. I want to thank UMass Amherst and the faculty, the administration for standing their ground, standing up for the values of this university to protect free speech. I want to thank Jewish Voice for Peace, Western Mass. We love you. I love you. And to my brilliant and bold sister, Rachel Weber, thank you for your courage and standing up for us. I want to thank my fellow panelists who are up here, Mark and Vijay and Roger and Dave, for their courage. They don't have to do this. I'm the resident Palestinian on the panel, just to be clear. So I have a responsibility to my people. They choose to stand up and be on the right side of history. So I want you to give them another round of applause. Everything we say this evening is on the record, even if it wasn't on the record. So I want to make sure that everybody understands that I stand here before you today, unequivocally and unapologetically Palestinian American. I stand here unequivocally and unapologetically proud with the blood of a resilient people that runs and pumps through my body. Woo. I am also a proud and unapologetic supporter of the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. Because I am trained in Kingian nonviolence, the ideology of Dr. Martin Luther King. I believe in the power of nonviolent means to bring about change. And if BDS was not an impactful and effective movement, they wouldn't be trying to oppose it. Not only do I believe in the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement as a nonviolent movement, regardless of what the opposition has to say about it, it's not just about belief, it's about my right and your right in the United States of America, upheld by the Constitution, that we have every right to boycott and divest in whatever ways we feel appropriate. So, instead of worrying about the tactics, just out-organize us. And I want to say shout out to Students for Justice in Palestine in every corner of this country for the bold and courageous work that they do every day. Why boycott, divestment, sanctions? This is a tactic. This is not an organization. It has been used in the days of the civil rights movement. It has been used to end South African apartheid. And let's be clear about what is happening in Palestine. They will say to me, why are you so obsessed with the state of Israel? Linda, they got countries all over the world who engage in the violation of human rights of people. They are absolutely correct. Countries like Saudi Arabia, countries like North Korea, countries like China oppressing 1 million Uyghur Muslims. So it's not lost on me that we live in a world where there is oppression happening in every corner of the world in which we live. Why the state of Israel? Because as a social justice activist, as a human rights activist, but also as an American, I work hard for my money. I hustle for my money. I pay this government my tax dollars. And as an American, I should be able to decide that my money should go to Medicare for All and schools in Chicago and hospitals in our country, and not to fund, and not to use our hard-earned money to fund an illegal occupation and oppression of a people like the Palestinian people. To fund the largest open-air prison in Gaza, to fund the dehumanization and deprivation and vilification of the Palestinian people, the chokehold on travel on the Palestinian people. So when you say to me, why the state of Israel, I say, why not the state of Israel? What inspires me as a Palestinian is the struggle of black people in America. And what we share with our black sisters and brothers in the United States of America is we find ourselves as Palestinians always trying to figure out how to defend our humanity. I'm tired of telling people why Palestinians like black people in America should be treated with the utmost dignity that they deserve. Not because they're black or because they're Palestinian, is because they are human and they are creations of God and deserve to be treated that way. We as the Palestinian people have been labeled anything and everything but who we are. We are a people with aspirations and dreams, a people fighting for self-determination and the right to return to our original homeland. We are a people with a rich culture, We are a people that know joy. We are a people that know laughter. We are a people that, as a famous Palestinian poet said, we are a people who teach life, sir.
Yeah.
People say to me, the state of Israel was created for the self-determination and the safety and sanctuary for the Jewish people. And I believe that all people, including the Jewish people, deserve safety and security and sanctuary. But what I will say is that there will be no state in this world that will have true safety and security at the expense of another people. What I know as a social justice activist, as a human rights activist, as a solidarity activist, is that our safety is in our solidarity. And that our liberation as Jewish people and Palestinian people and the Arab people is bound up with one another. And if we want to all be safe, we have to see the humanity in one another. Our opposition is fierce. They also got a lot of resources. But what they don't have is morals. They don't have principles. So instead of the opposition, right? This is what I say to the opposition all the time. I appeal to the morals and the values of the people. If you got a moral argument for your stance, then come bring it and see if people agree with you. But instead of appealing to the morals and the values of the people, they engage in ad hominem attacks against people who are truth tellers, people who are unbought and unafraid. And I will tell you, as a Palestinian American, as a daughter and granddaughter and great-great-great-granddaughter of Palestinians, that I will not be silenced. I will not be intimidated. And I will continue to stand strong in my positions. Just this week, this is just a week, because I could talk about the last, like, 10 years, the last 2 years, but I'm going to talk about this week. This week in the state of Texas, a Palestinian-American speech pathologist went up against anti-BDS supporters, went up against the state of Texas, who were trying to demand for her to sign a renewal contract with the Houston school district. And when they said in the contract that she had to sign the contract saying that she would confirm that she would not boycott the state of Israel, she said, absolutely not. And she went to the courts. And today I watched a video of her signing her contract without that clause in the contract. Just this week, I went to Winnipeg, Canada. The mayor of Winnipeg, he don't even know who I am. He probably never heard of me. But the right-wing Zionists got to the mayor of Winnipeg. And he stood up in a little press conference talking about, you don't gotta cancel, don't bring the lady or whoever the lady is. Whatever they told him to say, he said. And then we went from an event that could have probably had about maybe 200 people to a sold-out event in Winnipeg where more people heard my voice, more people heard my truth. Then I was about to deal with this event. And I was like, they took us to court and stuff and all this. I don't know. I was like, wait a minute, hold on. Are we in America? Do we live in a democratic country? Because I think I forget sometimes. And then thank God the judge still remembered that he was in a democratic country. And he threw out the injunction. So I was like, this is a lot of winning for 1 week. I'm sorry. There's a lot of winning happening. The way to convince people of your argument is by telling me how you're going to chop me up into little pieces or how you're going to kill me or threaten me or try to get me canceled from events. I'm just letting you know, and I'm giving you some free advice. I'm not even charging. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. Try some new tactics. There's a Mexican proverb that really resonates with me as a Palestinian, and it says, they thought that they buried us, but they did not know that we were seeds. And so I just want to say to everybody in this room that my first responsibility is to keep my family safe. But I will continue to use my voice, continue to stand up for the things that I believe in. And I am willing to do that no matter the consequences. Because Malcolm X said, if you're not ready to die for this, take that word freedom out of your mouth. And I will end my remarks with the words of a woman abolitionist who said, her name was Harriet Beecher Stowe. And Harriet said, when you get into a tight place and everything goes against you till it seems as though you could not hang on a minute longer, never give up then, for that is just the place and time that the tide will turn. And my dear sisters and brothers and family in this room, the tide is turning. Free, free Palestine! Free, free Palestine! Free, free Palestine! Free, free Palestine! Thank you, UMass Amherst!
Mark Lamont Hill. Is a well-regarded professor, but also a man who likes books. And if you go to Philadelphia, you should visit Uncle Bobby's. I first met Mark Lamont Hill in our joint long journey to free Mumia Abu-Jamal. There is something captivating about the river of justice because it floods and finds us all. Mark Lamont Hill.
Thank you, Vijay. And I saw what you did with that river thing. It is, it's overwhelming. First of all, it's hard to go after them. But it is overwhelming to see the response in this room today. 5 years ago, 10 years ago, I'm not sure we would have 50 people at an institution talking about this topic. But to see what's in the room today, to see who's in the room today, and to see the level of opposition to the conversation that we plan to have today is, as Linda said, a sign of our success. We are winning. We are moving forward. We are advancing justice. And we will win. The opposition to this event today was not surprising to me. We live in a country where there are always going to be competing claims, there are always going to be debates, there are always going to be spirited conversations about the right side of the issue and the wrong side of the issue. What was unsettling to me, as Dave pointed out, was the idea that because we stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people, that we are somehow anti-Semitic. That, for me, was hurtful on the personal level because all of us on this stage have worked so hard to fight anti-Semitism, to resist anti-Semitism, which is a very real thing both in the United States and also around the world. We could even argue in the Trump era that it is expanding and moving in ways that we never even saw before because of the evangelical right, because of historically persistent anti-Semitism, because of all the narratives of hate that are being promoted and promulgated in the media, often from the White House. Because of all of that, anti-Semitism is something that we must take seriously. Yeah. We must. Yeah. And as a social justice activist, as a person who identifies as a radical, I don't want to be part of any social justice movement that is transphobic, that is homophobic, that is anti-Semitic, that is Islamophobic, that is misogynist, that is patriarchal, that is ableist. No one is free until we are all free. There is no room for any injustice. So that's why I ain't think I did nothing too crazy when I went to the UN. They asked me to come to the UN to speak on behalf of the Palestinian people as a representative of civil society, as a non-Palestinian person. For me, as a black person, as an African in America, that meant that I was trying to stand in a tradition of African freedom fighters who have stood in solidarity with the Palestinian people. I'm talking about Malcolm X. I'm talking about Huey Newton. I'm talking about Angela Y. Davis. I'm talking about SNCC. I'm talking about Ethel Miner. I'm talking about all the freedom fighters who stood up and said we must stand against settler colonialism. We must be unafraid to name it. We must be unafraid to call it out. We must be unafraid to stand in justice and freedom and democracy. We stand in the tradition, and we will not be moved. We will not back down. We will not be silenced. So I'm flying back from Palestine, and I was near the river. Jordan River. I'm just being geographically specific, just to be clear. I don't want them problems. I don't want no smoke. I was near the Jordan River and I was traveling, and I flew back specifically for the UN speech. I landed in New York. I went to my crib in Brooklyn, got dressed, came back through. On the flight there, I wrote, now I don't write speeches, but I said, you know what? I'm gonna write this one. Because I don't want there to be any problems, any controversy. I went and read the previous 2 years. I think Roger had done a couple. I read your speeches. I was like, oh, shit, okay. There's a whole long line of troublemakers like myself. But I said, I will be specific. I will appeal to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We were there in November of 2018, 70 years after the Nakba, 70 years after the great catastrophe. And also 70 years after the establishment of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And what I was attempting to do was say that there is a contradiction between our universal commitment to human rights, ostensibly, our universal commitment to making sure that everyone has freedom and safety and self-determination and dignity, and what we see on the ground. When I'm in Khalil, when I'm in Hebron, and I'm looking at children have to go through checkpoints, and I'm looking at the ritual humiliation of being patted and searched at the age of 6 and 7. When I'm in Khan al-Ahmar, and I'm looking at this village of Bedouins, which is about to be torn down after they built schools out of tire and mud because they couldn't get permits. And I'm watching the village be torn down for the sole purpose of settlement expansion. When I'm looking on Via Dolorosa as Christians are honoring the stations of the cross, and at the very same moment that they look at their Savior carrying the cross, I'm looking at Palestinian children being stopped and searched and frisked in front of the Armenian hospice. I'm looking at these places. I'm looking at second-class citizenship inside of the state of Israel for Africans, citizens, and for refugees, and for people seeking asylum. I'm looking at a place where people have a gap between their expressed democratic ideals and their lived practice on the ground. And they said, well, like Linda said, why Israel? Why not Bahrain? Why not Saudi? I'm out there too. I can't say enough about what's wrong with Saudi. I can't say enough about what's wrong with Bahrain. I can't say enough about what's wrong with the United States of America. And I promise you,
I'm already criticizing Saudi. I'm already criticizing Bahrain, and I'm already criticizing Syria. I'm already doing these things. But the moment a call comes at a civil society from any of those countries for boycott, divestment, and sanction, I will back them too. It's not about isolating Israel. It's about speaking the truth everywhere. So I gave the speech. And to this day, I mean, I gave a 22-minute speech, and we only talk about the last six words. They make you scared to say them. What was it, window to the wall? What was it? I can't remember. And there was no critique of the speech or the content of the speech. Just this pretext of a critique of those last six words, from the river to the sea. And the question was, why use those words? Well, for a couple of reasons. One, people said it's from the Hamas charter. It's also in the Likud statement of 1974, the platform statement. I don't know if y'all got Twitter. That's Donald Trump's press team. If you look at Twitter, Benjamin Netanyahu's son last week said that he wanted to expand the Jewish state from the river to the sea. It's just fascinating. It's fascinating who gets to use the language and who doesn't. Part of how we police speech is to decide who can have this conversation and who cannot. But let me be clear to you, my dear friends, brothers, sisters, and informants. Shout out to the Mukhabarat in the back. When I say from the river to the sea, what I am talking about is a free, democratic, self-determined, safe, and just and equal land for everyone. For everyone. That means that we have to care about what's happening in Gaza, which is a human rights crisis. We have to. My people? People from North Philly? Shit, yo, somebody get Beanie Siegel. Somebody call Meek Mill. Hold up, wait a minute. Y'all thought he was finished? When he...
Let the speaker speak, I'm saying.
Ignore it.
And so...
Free Palestine.
And so, my dear brother, I want you to have a space to talk, just not while I'm talking. That's all I'm asking. I respect your right to free speech. I respect your right to have a different opinion in mind, but we can't talk at each other, and so let's have a dialogue. And at this point, just let me finish my words, and then we can talk later. Can you agree to that, my brother?
Excuse me.
Thank you. Thank you. So just allow me to finish this point, which I now forgot because I started thinking about Meek Mill. What are we talking about? Oh, right. So when I'm talking about the river to the sea, I'm specifically talking about the opportunity to talk about what the crisis in Gaza, to talk about what's happening in the West Bank, and to talk about the differential citizenship status for Palestinian citizens of Israel. I'm talking about all these areas. I want freedom in each of these areas, and we must be committed to having that conversation. Palestinian freedom does not mean Jewish destruction. It does not mean Jewish marginalization. We can have both. The challenge is that sometimes when you are in a position of power, when you are in the role of oppressor, equality looks like and feels like injustice. Oh my God, men are losing the company. We hired four women. But I digress. We must be committed to this solidarity work, despite the odds. I can't promise you that if you do this work and speak the truth, that you won't be fired. I almost got fired from a university where I have tenure. Now, think about this. The chairman of the board of trustees said that he was morally outraged by my speech. He had never seen or heard anything so disgusting before. He's Bill Cosby's attorney. Yeah, Google that. I can't even make this stuff up. Tenure is under attack. Our jobs are under attack. Our lives are under attack. What we're experiencing up here is just a small piece of the hell that people are catching around the world for speaking up on this and many other issues. I'm not suggesting a Jewish conspiracy. I am not saying that there's a cabal of power conspiring to take people down. Let me be very clear, because that is an anti-Semitic trope and a dangerous one. Let me be very clear about that. What I'm saying is that we live in a nation and in a moment where speaking up for justice, whether it's reproductive justice, whether it's housing justice, whether it's sensible gun legislation, or whether it's ending this vicious occupation, comes at a price. But we are committed to paying that price. We must all be committed to paying that price. Because if we stand up and pay that price together, they cannot get all of us. We cannot all be taken out. But if we continue to divide, if we continue to separate, if we continue not to hold on to the rope, then we won't be victorious. But the evidence is on our side. Yes, it's dark. Yes, they're trying to move the embassy. Yes, Trump is imposing policies that Congress has held back on, although they ultimately supported for years. Yes, violence is increasing. There are many reasons not to be optimistic about this moment, but as Dr. King said, it is only when it is darkest that we see the stars. This room is a star. This room is a bright, shining light. This room, this movement, this moment is evidence that we will be victorious. We will win. Palestine will be free. Free the land. Free Mumia. Free all political prisoners.
Roger Waters. Roger Waters, Pink Floyd, and Dark Side of the Moon saved me from my teenage years. I forgot to mention marijuana, but that's another thing. That I have to introduce Roger Waters is an embarrassment. Roger Waters.
Wow. How do you follow all that love? That is a lot of rub to come out of three people preceding you when you've got to get up to a podium and say something to a room full of people like this. But I will do my best. David Zarin, in the green room before we came out here tonight, asked me, he said, what happened? How did you get into this? What was the beginning of the story? And I thought, I've told this story a lot, but I'm going to tell it once more because he hadn't heard it and he said he thought I should. So here we go. I tacked a gig in Tel Aviv at the Haikon Stadium onto the end of a European tour in 2006. And immediately I started getting emails from all kinds of people. But one of the people I got an email from was Omar Barghouti, who 2 years before had been part of the committee that started the BDS movement in Palestine. They tried to prevail upon me to cancel the show that I was going to do there, and I did cancel it. I was persuaded by their arguments, But I came to a compromise, and I moved my show to an agricultural community halfway between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem called Neve Shalom, or in Arabic, Wahak Asalam, and which is a multi-faith kind of ecumenical community where Jews and Druze and Christians and Muslims all live together with their children, and the children all school together, and they all cooperate with one another. And it is an expression of brotherhood and love. So we did a gig there in the middle of an empty chickpea field. And it was the biggest gig anybody ever had in Israel. There were 60,000 people there. I was doing Dark Side of the Moon tour at the time. And the audience took hours and hours to get in, and blah, 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 blah. And they spent the whole night going like they do, you know. And I've got nothing against that. I love that, personally. But they did. Until we got to the end of the evening, when I said, I stood up in front of all that and said, you are the generation of young Israelis who must make peace with your brothers and sisters in the neighborhood and bring in a new era of et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they went from to, what the fuck's he talking about? In a heartbeat. And it was one of the most chilling sights I've ever seen in my life. I saw it later in various parts of Israel when I went back the next year. Anyway, that is the start of the story. And I went back the next year and traveled all around the West Bank. And it was a chilling experience, even though I was under the protection of the United Nations and a lovely woman called Allegra Pacheco, who worked for UNRWA at the time. I was devastated by my personal witness of the apartheid and oppression and the stealing and dispossession that I witnessed. And so I've been a small part of this movement ever since those times. Okay, moving on. I was going to talk about Paris in 1948 and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but Mark covered all that, so I'm screwed. Except to say, this is something I say at all my shows now. I say, all of you in this room, in fact, everyone in the world at some point, comes to a moment in their lives when they have to make a choice. They have to study the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, all 30 articles, and they have to decide for themselves whether they subscribe to the idea. Because, as we know, it is a fairly modern idea. It's only a couple of hundred years old. But so you have to ask yourself that question, or you do if you want to have any semblance of being a human being. And if you decide that you do subscribe to the definitions in the Declaration, you then have to decide whether you're prepared to stand behind it or not, as these people on this stage all are, and as I suspect most of you are, because it's fundamentally important to the way that you lead your life from that point on. All right, that's enough about the Fundamental Declaration of Human Rights. 10 years ago, and this really is a digression, but I don't care, because these three wonderful people on this stage with me have covered everything that I could say about Palestine and freedom for the Palestinian people, and have said it probably more eloquently than I could. However, 10 years ago, in 2008, just before Obama was elected as the President of the United States, I wrote a somewhat rambling poem, and I'm going to read it now. I've since made an album that has the same title, but the poem is quite different. It's called, Is This the Life We Really Want? I felt this poem kind of popping out of me as I drove from the airport today through this bit of Massachusetts and looking at all the clapboard farmhouses. And I felt as if I'm in the heart of something that is American here. So anyway, the concept of an average guy is patently absurd. There's too much differential in the herd. Just look at Bush and Cheney, then look at you and me. It's like comparing Shakespeare to reality TV. Is this the life we really want? Being murdered by these clowns? Our children crushed in rubble? Are we deafened by the sound of media mouths all moving in apparent unity, spewing out the mantra of the free? Free to plan the neo-land, safe in their bomb-proof lairs, free to send our sons to war, our sons, of course, not theirs, free to burn and pillage, to fill the family vault, free to claim it's dog-eat-dog and really not their fault. Fear drives the mills of modern man. Fear keeps us all in line. Fear of all those foreigners. Fear of all their crimes. Is this the life we really want? It surely must be so, for this is a democracy, and what we all say goes. We all say, kill bin Laden, kill Saddam Hussein, kill anyone collateral who might get in the way, kill all the dogs and shopkeepers, kill all the coppersmiths, kill everyone who chooses to be on the evil list, kill everyone who doesn't want to be our acolyte, kill everyone who disagrees that what we say is right. It's going to cost us trillions, already has in fact, but no price is too heavy to keep the faith intact, because we believe in freedom, human rights for everyone. Well, everyone, that is, except the ones we need to bomb. And if some of them are children and seem a bit forlorn, it's not our fault. They should have chosen somewhere different to be born. Anyway, I'm sure they'll all agree it's a success when we've tidied all the insurgents and tidied up the mess. Even though they may be crippled or rotting underground, they'll be happy when democracy's the only game in town. They can help to build our bases. They can wash our fancy cars. They can service all our carnal needs in pickup joints and bars. Against their religion, their religion's wrong. I'm sure they'll get the hang of it, catch on before too long. Then they can all watch baseball. They can build a Disneyland, eat pizza and McDonald's, drink bourbon, start a band. I know, no alcohol. The towel heads don't drink. The fuck, they'll soon get used to it. We'll have to have a think. I digress, I'm sorry. What was my train of thought? Oh yes, now I remember. Is this what we all ought to be devoting our resources to spread this rotten creed, teaching their dead children avarice and greed? Was it Truman Capote who famously railed, "It's not enough that I succeed, I need others to fail"? Is this the life we really want? To set ourselves at odds with every other species, not to mention other gods? I don't think so. In general, my experience has been that ordinary Americans, when asked to cite their dream, conjure an existence where they can raise their kids without the chafe of blowing other people's kids to bits. Is it my imagination? Is it too much to suggest that their leaders over there and our leaders in the West are driven not by trying to achieve peace in our time, but by something else, by something altogether less sublime? Call me a cynic, but it sometimes seems to me that some of them are more attached to power than to peace. Just supposing for a moment that they're in it for the cash, that they're looking out for number one, building up their stash. What better way to divert the attentions of the poor than an axis of evil and a good old-fashioned war? It's economics 101, as every schoolboy knows. War is good for business and diverts us from our woes. It's so unpatriotic to complain about our lot when our brave boys are out there in the desert getting shot. Imagine if the money that we're spending on the war was used instead to rebuild dikes and help rehouse the poor, to research cures for cancer and fund institutes to delve into ways of helping people less well-off than ourselves, to secure our docks and airports and power stations, to prevent the disaffected in our own and other nations from expressing their attachment to some vengeful deity in self-immolation, immolating you and me. Or is it power that gets them, being able to decide how to divvy up the cake, who should live, who should die? To have at their disposal all those sexy tanks and planes. Got you. No, I got you first, reliving boyhood games. Why don't we just stop them? Why don't we get tough, take to the streets in millions, say, enough is enough? Why? Why? It's obvious, because actually we, that's you and me, that's all of us, because actually we, all the blacks and all the whites, Chicanos, Asians, every type of ethnic group, even folks from Guadeloupe, the old, the young, the toothless hags, the supermodels, actors, fags, football stars, men in bars, washerwomen, tailors, tarts, grannies, grandpas, uncles, aunts, friends, relations, homeless tramps, clerics, truckers, cleaners, ants, maybe not ants, because it's true that ants don't have enough IQ to differentiate between the pain that other people feel and, well, for instance, cutting leaves or crawling across windowsills in search of opal treacle tins. So like the ants, are we just dumb? Is that why we don't feel or see? Or are we all just numbed out on reality TV? So every time, the roadside mine, the guided bomb, the ricochet, the Gatling gun, the tomahawk, the phantom, Mirage, RF squawk, the IED, the false hello, the cluster bomb with fries to go. Every time the curtain falls on some forgotten foreign life, rest assured it is because we did nothing to prevent our masters, dedicated as they are, not to protection of the weak, not to democracy, that we did nothing to prevent their headlong dash to maximize the bottom line. So what, if anything, to do? Well, understand that every day, in many small but central ways, we get to choose enslavement to the bottom line, with all that that implies, dog eat dog, God eat God. Did I mention freedom fries? Anyway, we get to choose, or so we're all led to believe. Well, now, in 2008, election year, who knows? It may well be too late, but just suppose if we all vote that we can start to bridge the gap between what we all have become and what we all just might have been. The gap between the blind and blinkered great unwashed, the laughing stock, the butt of universal scorn and enmity and wrath and grace and pride and leadership and light and beacons shining in the west, admired by both the old world and the third. Safe haven for the lauded claims in constitutions written fair on parchment years ago, when equality, fraternity, and liberty were rocks core-bedded in an earth emerging from a darker age. I do believe that we can spread our wings, take flight, renounce the darkness of the marketplace, reach out across the iodox's abyss, embrace our longing to be kinder, aye, and have more fun, and garnish less the moneylenders' nests, and touch and sing and breathe in relish of our new unfettered selves, embrace the law in that we all agree that standard issue kicking in our door, tapping phones, rendition, torture, waterboarding and the rest, the random shooting down on London's underground of someone's nephew from Brazil, however scared the powers that be, are alien to our beliefs, and so should be confined to memories of Hitler's Reich and, of course, to Uncle Joe's gulag archipelagos. So are we babies that we need to be protected, that left unfettered thrashing we might hurt ourselves, that they, the Cheneys, Putins, Bushes, Blairs, and all their spawn and all their heirs, in all their ruinous, bankrupt, fearful crap, that they somehow should have the power to keep us at each other's throats, impotent, straight-jacketed, squabbling over dimes and groats like infants in our swaddling clothes. Fuck them. Enough. They've had their time. A new day dawns, and we will not be swaddled in their grime.
You have been listening to part two of the recorded May 4th, 2019 forum at UMass Amherst called Not Backing Down. Next week, we continue our coverage of the forum, featuring the rich discussion among the participants, as well as the question and answer portion of the program. And that's it for today. We're out of time. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.